SafetyFM.com with Jay Allen. Changing safety cultures, one broadcast and one podcast at a time.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen, which sometimes can get extremely confusing because we have a podcast network called Safety FM, we have a radio station called Safety FM, and then we have this little show that is Safety FM with Jay Allen. Because if I just called the episode or the show Jay Allen, it would be very confusing on like, what does that even mean? So anyways, how are you? I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods, because it is always important as you and I get to hang out and do the things that we get to do. No doubt about that. Anyways, we are still taking a look back at some of the stuff that we did in the month of February while we were down in Wollongong at the Global Safety Innovation Summit that was going on down there in Australia. And today, oh my, do we have one that you're going to sit back and need to take a listen. And I have a feeling that this is going to be one of these episodes you're probably going to have to listen not to once, not to twice, but probably three times, because Drew Ray has so much information that he unpacks during this episode, and there are so many different little neurons and nuances in regards of what he's talking about and all these little things that you need to pay really close attention to, because there is a lot of data that is driven behind this particular episode. So here's what's going to happen. We're going to take a listen to his speech on what was going on. And then at the end of the speech, we're going to have Zoe Nations come up, ask some questions to him. And then after that, I'll jump in into the exclusive interview that we did post-event. And I'm talking about post his speech at right there inside of the bridal suite. Yes, because I had the opportunity of being in the bridal suite. So me and Drew were able to go into the bridal suite, have a brief conversation. So take a listen to this. And he might drop a hint or two about disaster gas. Might want to take a listen to that. Anyway, so let's go ahead and get that started right now with Drew Ray here on Safety FM with Jay Allen.
Thanks, Ari, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, I'm not sure I really wanted the introduction of Drew. He makes people uncomfortable when he meets them. But since we're apparently now going to start each talk with a moment of radical transparency, I'll let you know that pretty much every time I speak in public, regardless of the title on the slides, what I'm really doing is making a pitch to you to be involved in research partnership. Not in a vague sense of, hey, I wish my company would do business with the Safety Science Innovation Lab or anything like that, but you personally, as practitioners, to be part of an evidence-based profession. And so at the end of this talk, I'll tell you right now what the takeaway is going to be. Is I'm going to put up a slide that says takeaway, and I'm going to tell you that innovation is about more than simply being inspired. It's about translating that inspiration into evidence-based improvement within our organizations. Now, along the way, we're going to talk about zero harm. But as a preview to that, I'm going to tell you a story about one of the biggest projects I've ever had the opportunity to manage in my career. This was pretty important. It was going to make or break the research lab. We had multiple researchers whose livelihood was dependent on the success of this project. It was a personal risk for the individuals within our business partner who were sponsoring the project, putting their reputations and positions in their company on the line to try out something that was genuinely radical. And the challenge was that this company had a zero harm policy. As a result of this zero harm policy, everyone, either on their high vis or on their business shirts, had the word zero harm on their pocket. Now, that's the challenge, it's not the problem. The problem was that I worked with a guy called Sydney Decker. Now, I don't know if you've met Sydney. Many of you may have heard him talk yesterday. But every single interaction with the client started with Sydney noticing the zero harm written on their pocket and mocking them, So I'm trying to manage a large project. I'm trying to manage interpersonal relationships that matter. I'm trying to do safety research, which is going to generate the safety clutter work, is going to generate the take five work, is going to produce some of the best research I've done in my life. And in my head, I'm screaming throughout these meetings, Sydney, shut the hell up. The words on the pocket don't matter. Zero harm doesn't matter. What matters is the people. What matters is the relationships. What matters what we are doing together. Now, it turns out I was wrong. The words actually did matter. Words carry ideas. Ideas shape strategies. Strategies ultimately bring action and change. This was some of the best research I've done in my life, some of the best people I've worked with in doing innovation. And the company was not able to capitalize on the work that we did. And I think in large part, it was because of the word zero harm on their pocket and the ideas they conveyed and the structures and strategies that come from that and the way it facilitates or impedes action within the organization. But I was also right in that the words, they're just a couple of words. They don't mean that much. They matter because of their link to particular strategies and their link to particular actions. And so that's where we're headed in this talk. Now, we've got a fairly varied audience here. You've probably twigged by now that the organising committee and all of the presenters at this conference have pretty much drunk the Kool-Aid on a particular view of safety. Some of you are here because you have also drunk the Kool-Aid. Some of you are here because you've been dragged along by people who've drunk the Kool-Aid, or because you got a free ticket from someone at your company who's drunk the Kool-Aid, sponsored the conference, and dragged you along. Some of you are here as genuine learners. Some actually as university students, some as broader learners in life and in your organisations. What I don't know is exactly what the balance is here. And when you're pitching a talk on a topic as polarising as zero harm, you really need to know where the audience is currently sitting in order to say something that is useful without getting booed or laughed off the stage. So we're going to run a little bit of audience interaction. I am going to put up the next slide, then I'm going to give you a three count, and then I would like your immediate response to that slide. That response may be at one end of the spectrum something like, hell yes. That may be some sort of boo and hiss. Depending on your response, that's pretty much going to guide how the rest of this talk is going to go. So, okay, you ready? Slide, three count, your immediate reaction, please. Three, two, one. Okay, this is your own fault. You chose the version of the talk you're about to get. Anything from here on in is me reacting to your request for what sort of talk. Just bear that in mind afterwards, please. This slide is, in fact, a truth. Zoe challenges to tell the truth. And as a scholar, as a researcher, someone who is deeply familiar with the literature, someone who knows how to read academic papers, this is the current state of evidence in our field. The preponderance of real research shows a link between companies having a zero harm policy and a positive response in lost time injury rates. What can we do with that information? Number one is we can all just decide, hell, that's what the evidence says. We want to be evidence-based practitioners. Let's all adopt zero harm. Anyone with me? Nope. Okay. Option number two, the evidence sucks. This is actually important. This is actually driving attitudes and thoughts, not just in companies, but in like global safety organizations. If we want to have arguments about this, we really should get better evidence so that we can be armed with more than anecdotes when we say we don't like zero harm. Option number three, we say, forget about the evidence. This isn't really about evidence. Safety is all about binaries, right? It's all about big ideas. We can be on this camp and this camp. Choose your side, choose your practices based on which side you're in, and mock everyone else. Hopefully, it's a little bit clear that I'm following down the middle path. But that loud boo sort of suggested that we may be at odds on this. So have a think about that. So I'm going to use an approach for the next part of this talk that comes from one of my researchers, Jop Havinger. I don't know if you've ever met Jop. You have probably encountered his work if you've seen any paper that I've published. Jop doesn't just do field research within organizations. He's also got an incredible brain for trying to understand why people do the things that they do at work. And his approach to anything that he is skeptical of, more often his approach to anything that I'm skeptical of when he's reining me in, is to say, look, as a researcher, you can't really come in from the outside and just claim that you know better than people who've had 20 years of experience within an organization with these practices. If you want to criticize things, you need to understand them from the direction of the people who are proposing those practices. So with something like zero harm, we don't want to just go in, it works, it doesn't work. We want to ask the people who are seriously in favor of zero harm what their best arguments are, what their thinking is, what their rationale is. Now, fortunately, zero harm tends to be adopted as company-wide safety policy, which means it's never just the word zero harm. It's zero harm along with a long document that espouses lots of big broad brush statements about the intent of the policy. So we've got a lot of language that goes along with zero harm explaining exactly what it is. For those of you who haven't been in a company that's got this sort of approach, zero harm is kind of an umbrella term. Sometimes it's zero harm, sometimes it's zero accident vision. Sometimes it's some other words followed by a sentence that says, ultimately the goal of safety in our company is to reduce the number of major accidents to zero. And when we say zero harm, that's what we mean, is just having that attitude that we are aiming towards zero major accidents or injuries. And there are several different things that people mean when they take this approach. The first one is an aspirational goal. So this is, yeah, we know that zero is impossible. That's not the point. It's an aspiration. The second one is it's a symbolic commitment. This is the value we hold that every accident is preventable, that every accident shouldn't happen, and we are committed to not having accidents. And the third one is literally the belief that it's an achievable performance goal. And so you see some policies that say, you know, if we want to get to zero harm, these are the things that we will do that will take us there, that make it very clear that people see it as a concrete, achievable goal. Now, the first thing I want you to notice is that these three things are actually entirely inconsistent. I've seen policy statements that bundle all three into the same statement. We have an aspirational goal to which we make a commitment to actually get there. But taken separately, they're things where we can study the evidence behind. Do these actually work? So the idea of an aspirational goal is something that is commonly associated with innovation within organizations. If you look up things like stretch goals or seemingly impossible goals, you see this body of literature about organizations that are undergoing radical transformation. And the way the approach is supposed to work is you set a goal that seems impossible based on the current way you're doing things. So obviously you can't get to that goal just by trying a little bit harder, by being a little bit more efficient, by being a bit more committed. The only way to reach an impossible goal is to change the paradigm, to change the rules of the game, to genuinely completely change how we're going about things in order to get to that goal. That's one theory of zero harm, is that it is an impossible goal, but it's an impossible goal that motivates that kind of radical change. And there is evidence that this sometimes works. It works under very particular conditions, though. It works, firstly, in organisations that have had recent success. So, you know, when you set people an impossible goal, there's really two paths they can go. They can say, hey, that's impossible. We're used to management setting as impossible stuff. We're just going to give up. The other one is organisations that are used to success, that are used to achieving their goals, that have got a recent track record of doing the impossible, beating their competitors. In those organisations, setting them big, big challenges motivates people even further. So there is some logic behind this idea that if you're in an organisation that is already doing safety really well, maybe the next way to get to change is to set some sort of impossible goal. But what would that look like in terms of strategy? You'd be trying to set up an environment where it's personally safe to fail. So we're not talking about like you zero harm, an accident happens and everyone immediately reacts in horror and sets a personal commitment, we're not going to allow this to happen again. We're talking about an organisation where an accident happens, people say, good work, you were trying something different. Let's try something else that's also different. You know, environment that's really actually encouraging and rewarding risk-taking and being okay with things going wrong. We're talking about an organisation that is devoting resources not just to experimentation and trying new things, but to properly evaluating those new things so it can find out what works and doesn't work. We're talking about an organisation where there's a sense of progress and achievement in safety constantly as we try out new things, roll out new things. So that is one version of zero harm. And if you were to say to me, Drew, my company is adopting a zero harm policy, come and partner with us because we want to experiment. We want new ideas. We want to try new things. I would see that as totally logically consistent, in line with all of the available evidence, and I would happily join you in a zero harm project that was taking that sort of aspirational approach. The second vision of zero harm, and this is really totally different, is the idea that zero harm is an ethical commitment. Now, this is kind of interesting because what we're committing to here is not really zero harm as a goal, but zero harm as a value. So we value this sort of underlying philosophy that no accident is acceptable, every accident would ultimately be preventable. But what we're actually committing to is a particular set of actions that we think are consistent with that value. So, you know, a sprinter who tells themselves that they're going to get their time under 10 seconds has an absolute commitment to that ultimate goal of under 10 seconds, but that doesn't mean every day they're practicing running that fast. It means they're using that goal and that commitment to help themselves every day get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, to help themselves every day go to the weight room and go through those particular actions that they know are eventually going to take them towards that value. And there's a lot of evidence behind this approach as well. There's a huge amount of research in goal commitment strategies and philosophies, how well they work in business, how well they work in sport. But like with the aspirational goal, there's a particular set of conditions under which this sort of philosophy and associated strategy work. So the first thing you need is you need to actually know what actions to take, which means you've already got to have a strong evidence base for exactly what we need to do to make the organisation safer. If you don't have that evidence base, if you don't have those clear actions, then there's no point in having the commitment. The second thing that you need is you need widespread belief throughout your organisation that those are the right set of actions. And they need to be the right set of actions at every level. It can't be we expect our workers to commit to wearing PPE and our managers just commit to, we're going to make the workers wear PPE. It's got to be, you know, clear evidence-based actions and commitments that everyone is making that involve personal sacrifice and prioritization for each person. It's got to be consistent that you can see everyone else around you publicly expressing the same actions, but also publicly taking their own specific actions that they are going to take towards that goal. The quickest way to give up on a joint pact that you're going to exercise is if your exercise partner is sleeping in. You're not going to yourself get up and continue to meet that goal. And again, there has to be some sort of feedback on progress. You've got to see that you are somehow getting closer to that goal, that those actions are working. And again, that comes back to the evidence-based practice. So if you were to say to me, Drew, I want to adopt zero harm. I want to adopt zero harm as an ethical commitment because I already know the best way to manage safety. In that case, I'd say no, because I just don't believe you that we've got a good evidence base of exactly what actions we need to make ourselves safer. But if you're in an organization where you genuinely believe you know the next steps, you've got a 5-year plan of safety improvement. You don't need more research because you already know what the problems are, you already know what the solutions are, you just haven't done them yet. Then zero harm would be perfectly consistent with that strategy. It would be the exact label to put onto a strategy of unified commitment towards publicly expressed values and individual actions. Now, hopefully I've been fairly reasonable so far. So you'll trust me when I say that zero harm as a concrete performance goal is absolute nonsense. It makes no sense. And it makes no sense even on its own terms. Because even if you're the sort of person who believes in things like KPIs, the logic of any KPI is that everything we do in an organization has variability. And safety is not some sort of special child where we can say, oh, we'll set KPIs for everything else, but not for safety. Everything, even sales, has some things we can control, some things that we can't control. Safety is just the same as that. So it's not that safety should be immune from any other sort of measurement or tracking or performance. The trouble is that normally when we're setting a goal, that variability can cancel out. If we achieve well above the goal, it's because we did the right things and we were lucky. If we get well below the goal, it's because we did the wrong things and we were unlucky. Over time, the lucky and the unlucky cancel out, and ultimately you end up with something which is a reasonable indicator of who is performing well, what strategies are working, what needs to be changed. That's the way KPIs work. The trouble is that if you're working towards zero, things can't cancel out. Sometimes you will be very lucky and you'll have no accidents. Sometimes you'll do everything well and you'll have no accidents. But all of the variability has to go in the other direction. So over time, if you set zero as your KPI, everyone, every business unit, every person will ultimately either underperform or start lying to you because there's no other choice. There's no variability either side of zero. One way to think about that is every time someone goes to work, they're rolling a set of dice. So every person, every day, rolls the dice. If they come up all sixes, that person is going to be injured or killed at work. Nothing we do can stop the dice rolling. We can add more dice to the pool. If someone's in an office, we give them a couple of extra dice. If someone's out in the field, we take away a couple of extra dice. Someone comes to work tired or under the influence, they lose a few dice. Someone gets extra training, they become super competent, we add in a couple of extra dice. So we can adjust the amount of risk that someone faces. There's things they can do themselves, there are bigger things we can do as an organization that make the risk go down by adding dice. But no amount of dice that you add ever stops the dice from rolling. it's a myth to think we can be at zero outcomes because we can never be at zero risk. We can't even come close in mathematical terms to zero risk. So there are things that we can do to measure the number of dice, but we can't measure that number by whether we roll all sixes or not. Am I making sense here? This is just a sort of like fundamental underlying mathematics of risk is zero makes no sense as a target. And targets that make no sense lead to bad management strategies. So if you tell me, Drew, we've set zero as our target, we're doing zero harm, and we've literally made it a KPI, that's the point at which I start laughing and mocking people for having zero harm written on their shirts. Now, we try hard in safety not to blame workers for things that they do wrong. And I think it's really important that we also take that same attitude to studying management and leadership as well. Bad leaders are not bad leaders. They are people who are put into situations that lead to bad leadership. Why is it then that people have these goals that seem like nonsense? One of the reasons is there is constant demand for board reportable safety outcomes. That's just an inevitability in modern organizations, is people are trying to govern us. They want to govern us quantitatively. Everyone else is willing to toe the line. Everyone else suffers those same problems with target variability, with uncertainty. Safety is not a special child. Safety doesn't deserve to be treated separately and differently when it comes to measurement and management and leadership under the same pressures. Looking downwards through the organization, business units and individual teams need clear guidance on what they should prioritize. They don't want mixed messages. They don't want to be caught in this bind where we're half saying that safety is important, but we're sending other signals that other things are more important. They want very clear messages about what matters, what doesn't matter, what they will be judged on, what they will be rewarded for. As a community of practitioners and researchers, we have seriously let businesses down by never being able to come up with good indicators for safety. All existing leading indicators for safety are not performance indicators in any sense of what makes good a good KPI. And none of the things we call leading indicators are actually leading indicators. And we're in a situation, the one thing that does make safety special is that setting a non-zero target looks and feels actively immoral, and may in fact be treated as actively immoral by people outside the organization, particularly in the event that an accident happens. So under those situations, lacking good evidence otherwise, I am highly sympathetic to anyone who has a zero harm policy. Because under those sort of pressures, it kind of seems really hard or impossible to have anything else. So, yeah, mathematically, mock them for the words on the pocket. Maybe psychologically and socially, cut them a break. Okay, but this wouldn't be fair if I just talked about the arguments for zero harm and the rationale for zero harm. There are people who hate zero harm. There are people who are trying to get rid of zero harm from their own organizations or have got rid of zero harm. What do they say about their key reasons for why it happens? And what's the evidence behind those reasons? I promise you that this is not just a public speaking thing. These things genuinely do show up in threes. So three reasons why people don't like zero harm. One of them is the claim that zero harm causes excessive focus on minor injuries at the expense of major injuries. Secondly is the idea that zero harm policies suppress reporting. And thirdly is the idea that setting impossible targets sets people up for failure and cynicism. So what's the actual evidence behind each of these claims? What's the evidence that zero harm causes excess focus on minor incidents? None. common claim, we've actually got no evidence that this is in fact the case. What we do have evidence for is that measuring injuries as an outcome, in particular classifying things as reportable or non-reportable or lost time or not lost time, we know that sort of binary measurement behaviour definitely does skew which injuries we focus on. We've got good evidence of that. Now, I've never seen a zero harm policy that isn't also paired with the injury measurement. So they're definitely associated, but it's the injury measurement, not the zero harm, that's actually causing, as far as we know, the focus on minor incidents. Second thing is, does zero harm suppress reporting? Again, zero evidence. Don't make that claim because you can't back it up. Someone challenges you, asks you for the evidence, asks you for the papers, best you'll be able to produce is anecdotes. What we do know for absolute sure is that tying zero to any sort of bonuses, tying them to KPIs and implicit rewards through promotions and performance evaluations, we know that suppresses reporting. And so again, I've never seen a zero harm program that wasn't also actually giving some sort of incentive or reward linked to zero harm. But again, it's the incentive, it's the celebrating getting to zero as if you've somehow reached the target. That's what causes the suppressing, not the actual simply having the words or policy, zero harm. So how about the does zero harm create cynicism? This is kind of hard because we've kind of interfered with the experiment. We've got all of these people saying that zero harm is nonsense. So even if zero harm didn't cause cynicism, it kind of does now. And it's kind of our fault. So, yeah, don't have research evidence on that one, but it's pretty clear that zero harm is controversial enough that simply the controversy alone is now a bit of a problem. So where does this leave us? I promised you at the start that there were multiple versions of this and multiple stories, but they all come eventually to the same spot, which is I actually think that there are at least three different strategies your organization could adopt, which are philosophically consistent and consistent with the evidence. The first strategy is you could adopt zero harm or support zero harm or keep zero harm and make it very clear that this is a stretch goal, that this is seemingly impossible, it is intentionally so, and it is part of a program of innovation and disruption. If you were making that claim, then the last thing that you could be doing would be reacting angrily to incidents and injuries. You would instead be deliberately funneling resource into innovation and experimentation. You would be creating psychological conditions not based around commitment, but around celebration of taking risk and trying to create disruptive, radical change. That would be philosophically consistent. That would be consistent with the evidence about how those sort of umbrella, seemingly impossible goals work. The second approach you could take is you don't claim that zero is aspirational. You claim that it is values-based, that it is a commitment philosophy paired with a specific program of action. So the title is zero, but what you want people to focus on are the bullet points underneath, the specific actions that your organization is taking and the specific actions that you want individuals within that organization to take. And the zero harm is just the label you give to that suite of actions that people are committing to. Again, evidence-based, that sort of high-level values commitment paired with specific goal commitments does work for improvement. Totally philosophically consistent. The third approach you could take is you get rid of zero harm, or you fight against zero harm, or you don't adopt zero harm, and you mock other people who have zero harm. But in order to remain philosophically consistent, you'd need to do the same thing you'd do in those other programs, which is work out what are the actual values you're expressing by not having zero harm. You would be committing to being open and transparent about non-zero risk in your organization. You could not say we have a zero tolerance for accidents. You could not react to accidents as if you had a zero tolerance. You could not measure injuries as an outcome because you're philosophically opposed to this idea of the harms that go with it. You could not set safety KPIs or implicitly reward performance based on the absence of injuries. You couldn't put on your resume, here is the safety program that I made, and for 3 years we had a decreasing lost time injuries, or we had no injuries for 3 years. You would need to take actions consistent with rejecting zero as a philosophy and as a goal. So that's kind of the point I'm leaving this for, the sort of inside message of this talk, is it doesn't actually matter whether you have zero harm or not. What matters is that you have a clear strategy for change and improvement within your organization, paired with high-level messaging, which is consistent with that strategy. It's the mixed messages, or the wanting to have it all and wanting to be both aspirational and have commitments, that lead to confusion, that lead to goal conflict coming from the top of the organization down. Your goal conflict is inevitable. Let's not make it worse by the signals that we're sending. But I also promised you that the ultimate takeaway of this wasn't actually about zero harm. The failure mode or risk of a conference like this is we have a whole bunch of people who are professional speakers who are very good at their job of selling high-level messages about safety. And so we're sitting in the audience and these ideas seem crystal clear. And then next week, we're back in our own organizations and we're trying to explain what we heard and learned. And what seemed crystal clear a few days ago just suddenly seems really hard to explain. And the trap is we then say, okay, I can't explain this myself. I've got to get in Bob Edwards, or I've got to get in Todd Conklin, I've got to get Sid Decker to come and talk to my board for me, to sell the message for me, because it was really clear when they said it, but it's hard for me to say it. And once you follow down that path, you're then, if you manage to successfully sell the message, you're then having to know, what do we do about it? And we're getting in consultants to help us implement learning teams and consultants to help us change our investigations. And this is the trap of inspirational innovation, is we think it comes from outside people telling us what to think. And then we join that crowd, we join those ideas, and we become followers. That's not how innovation works. Researchers aren't here to give you good ideas. We're here to be good at summarizing the evidence for you and partnering with you in improving that evidence base. I think someone asked on day one if people were familiar with safety clutter. That's not something that should be credited to the Safety Science Innovation Lab. That's something that should be credited to Downer and specific to the Logan Water Infrastructure Alliance, because they're the ones who actually put up the commitment to investigate deeply and honestly within their own organisation to explore those sorts of ideas in partnership. And it really wasn't even the organisation. It was really a guy called Christian who just thought, I want to be evidence-based myself. I want to be part of a project which is genuinely finding out what is going on. Now, I'm not criticising the idea of these big ideas. Ideas have value. Words carry ideas. Ideas carry meaning. Meaning carries strategy. Strategy leads to action. But in the end, it's the action that matters. We value the ideas because that's where the ideas take us. Zero is imaginary. Talk to mathematicians, some will tell you zero isn't even a number. It's just a kind of placeholder. And we just kind of pretend that zero is real, pretend that it's a number, because it's useful. And if we pretend that zero exists, it lets us get stuff done. And ultimately, that's where we are with any ideas in safety. Words are just words. They're just placeholders. They're not actually values. What matters ultimately is that we change the practice that we're doing, change what we're doing day to day as people, in line with what evidence tells us will help people be safer at work. So that's it from me. Not sure if we've got time for questions, Zoe.
Thank you so much, Drew. I think you definitely stuck to the brief and told us some truths. Did you guys feel a little bit uncomfortable, but not too uncomfortable, which is good. the good uncomfortable. So I think we needed you to do that. And so I really encourage you to look at the research and the work that Drew's doing. And did you hear him offer that he'll partner with you if you're doing something worthy?
Try not to be too subtle with that one.
So we do have time for a couple of questions that have come in. Here you go. So why is the goal of reducing SIFs, so serious incident fatalities, inconsistent with rejecting zero harm? Is the problem zero or the measurement itself?
Sorry, there are a number of different knots in that question, yeah. So let me just try to unpack. We know that when we start to measure injuries, this requires us to classify things to be injuries or not injuries, or reportable or not reportable. And that decision happens at many places in the organisation. It happens with the person who's actually been hurt. It happens with the supervisor who decides what action. It happens with the safety team who gets the report in and decides whether this is recordable, non-recordable, reportable, not reportable. That's where the harm is happening, is in that binary process of counting things instead of trying to understand things. So, yeah, it doesn't really matter whether you got zero or not. What matters is, are you thinking in these sort of binary counting terms is what's leading to the harms.
Yep. Thanks, Drew. That was not an easy question. So what about, is there any evidence that organisations can distinguish in practical terms between an actual target and a commitment?
I have no idea. If anyone listens to David and I on the podcast, a lot of what we do is we get sort of like questions like that in, and we look at each other and think, we've got no idea, let's go have a look. And get back to you in a couple of weeks with an answer. And if the answer's interesting, we'll get back to you in a couple of months with an episode. So that's all the answer I'm going to give you to that
one
now.
That's a good answer. Okay, and the last one. Is there a real difference between zero harm, target zero, and vision zero?
I have no logical reason to think there would be a difference between those things. And there's certainly no evidence of a distinction between those things. In the academic literature, it mostly gets called zero accident vision, just I think because it creates a good search term that no one else is using. The reason for using different language like vision zero, mission zero, and so forth is just to make your own safety brand searchable on Google. I'm not kidding. That's actually the it's a branding exercise.
Okay, and one for me, just a really quick one to entertain me. What do you think about Beyond Zero?
Cross-reference back to my previous answer, which is clever branding because it's probably more searchable than zero harm.
Okay, we're not sure it's achievable.
If zero beyond isn't logical, zero. Beyond yeah. zero just drives my head in as an engineer.
Okay, I just wanted to thank you so much, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks, Zoe.
Okay, Drew, directly off the stage, we ran you right in here.
Hi, Jay.
How do you think it went? You read the room. I could tell you were reading the room the whole time. So how do you think it went?
I honestly have no idea.
I mean, you brought up terms inside of there that people use inside of their organizations day in and day out. And they use it like normal terms. And all of a sudden, you're talking about zero harm. And the room's looking at you. These are verbiage that some organizations use, and all of a sudden you're giving them empirical evidence on what they're doing good, what they're not doing good, and this term that they're using truly has no evidence. How do you think it went?
So what I honestly don't know is which organizations feel that they have zero harm and which don't. A lot of organizations are a little bit covert. I think my favorite is Lang O'Rourke, who had Mission Zero
and then got really into the safety differently movement. And so then they had MZ next gear on their pockets. So everyone knew that it covertly stood for zero. And so, yeah, the message I was trying to get across is that it's not really about that top level. It's about the underlying thinking. And the two are paired. You know, often having zero harm, vision zero, comes with particular attitudes. But also often people celebrate that they've got rid of zero harm, but they've still kept a lot of the attitudes and metrics and responses to accidents.
So when you look at this and you look at, let's say, for instance, larger scale companies, and we'll even say organizations, and I'm sure you've seen that some of them that come out of the US that have fully committed behind the zero harm thing, and they come to you and say, hey, these are problems that we're running into. What's your thought process there?
So I guess my immediate thought is wanting to understand what they think they mean when they say they've fully committed to zero. And often just that next question totally shapes the conversation. Because some people will say outright, oh, we know it's aspirational. It's visionary. It's not intended to be a real goal. And that's another conversation. It's okay, if you're looking for something aspirational, are you taking actions that are consistent with innovating and disrupting towards something that's aspirational? And some people, when they say they're committed, they just mean, oh, I'm committed as if it's like a value. I haven't really thought about what zero means. It's just, it didn't seem morally possible to say anything else.
Yeah, because you can't imagine a lot of people turning around and saying, oh yeah, our goal is one or two, because then you start determining who that person is before you move forward.
Exactly. So the real question is, okay, you committed to zero as a value, but what are you doing? What goes with that action in terms of what are your actual plans? What are your actual processes? What are your actual actions and changes that you're making?
So when you start doing this research and you're looking at it from a lab perspective, and not to be mean here, but you essentially have to dumb it down to give it to people to inform them of, hey, you might be taking the incorrect approach. How do you feel about doing this? And we're among friends. Nobody's listening. It's just you and I here.
Jay, you know I'm deeply uncomfortable with dumbing things down and trying to simplify them. I feel guilty just when I give a 30-minute talk on stage, because I know that every sentence I'm saying unpacks to something that is more complicated and more nuanced. You make statements like, there's no evidence. I don't mean there's no evidence. I mean, I've read a few papers and I wasn't impressed with the research quality, and I've summarized it as, there's no evidence. I say, there's good evidence. I don't mean there's like a direct one-to-one connection between this and that. I mean, you piece together the pattern of literature, the pattern of different things people have studied, what's comparable, what's translatable. So, yeah, and that's the trouble with things like even just having a conversation about zero harm is inevitably we're dumbing it down to binaries. Does it work? Does it not work? Is there evidence? Is there not evidence?
And you start taking a look at it. I mean, you look at this information day in and day out, and you're doing it from a researcher point of view. You're not looking at it from, hey, let's go do some new marketing campaign like some organizations are trying to do. And you kind of hit on that in some high level towards the end there when you started bringing in the questions. So let's kind of deviate a little bit. You get to go speak in different places. We're here right now in the gong, as like people like to say around here. When you look at this and you're seeing that there's 603 people inside of this room at this summit for the first time in regards to them putting this on, what's your general feeling? Do you think that the world's changing around us?
No.
Okay.
I'm seeing part of a pattern that's played out in safety many times before. This is not the first critical movement that's been uncomfortable with safety practice and wanted to lead change. It's not even the first sociology-minded critique of safety practice. And they've all gone the same way. And part of what I'm trying to do is not put the brakes on it, because I think it's an inevitable pattern, but trying to hijack or steer the understandable frustration and desire for change, but to try to steer that towards more evidence-based thinking, because I think that's what ultimately breaks the cycle of safety wars.
So let's look at that real quick then, because you come from academia, and it's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's depending on how you want to look at it. So somebody who's, let's say, entry level, they're coming into this for the first time. They're hearing this information. You're looking at it from a different perspective. Where would you tell them to start? How would you go about going through this pattern and saying, okay, this is your should be your starting point and then moving forward, especially this is the first time them ever hearing this.
I would tell them to start with the smaller questions rather than the big questions. So not safety differently, safety one versus safety two, not are people the problem or people the solution. Start with what am I doing today? Why am I doing it? What's the underlying theory and evidence behind what I'm doing? And what can I learn about what we already know and turn that into both better practice and more evidence-based practice? And if it's simple as I'm going onto site to have a conversation, okay, there's a body of research about going onto sites and having conversations.
Well, and keep in mind that most people don't do general research. It's just, let's use the bad thing, it's going through the feeling. It's going through that moment in time of, this is how I feel. Oh my God, I had an emotional response to something that I heard. So it's not going to be research that you would normally do. So when you look at that and you hear something like that, is there maybe a different path? Is there a book for them to start off with? Maybe you start off with this. Maybe you start off with that. Maybe even a paper that you've written, or maybe even a paper that you've seen. Would that be somewhere you would tell them to start? And I'm not trying to lead you. Please understand that. I'm just trying to see, you know, because sometimes it has to be simplified, and there has to be a good starting point, because not everybody's going to be able to start where you're at.
Let me dodge your question and then come back.
Okay. Most people don't tell me that they're dodging their question. They just try to give me a different answer.
So if you said that to me and I was a doctor, mm-hmm. I would look at
you. But you are a doctor. Hold on.
A medical doctor.
Okay.
I would look at you in horror.
Right.
This idea that just because I'm starting off means that I can just go with the feelings and the vibe.
Right.
You know, doctors hold people's lives in their hands as much as safety professionals do. And the idea that you would just go out and do something based on the vibe.
Right.
Now, what that means is if someone is going into a safety practitioner role and we have put them into that situation, we have badly let them down in their education, that they have come out of training or out of maybe even university studies in safety, and we haven't taught them how to start working with evidence to guide their practice, then we've failed them as teachers.
But let's not joke around. At some level, there are still organizations out there that put people in safety as a form of punishment, or, you've been here for a while, so maybe you should just be a good filler because you can understand it better than others.
Oh, in that case, the answer is simple. Resign. If you are in a safety role and you haven't been equipped and set up for that role, you are going to do harm. You are going to hurt people. And the best thing you can do for yourself and anyone else is to get out of that situation.
I love your honest approach to this. I really do. Because most people wouldn't be that direct. So I love how you're coming and you're approaching it. So if people want to find out more about what you're doing, where can they find you?
Okay. So the easiest way to find me is to follow me on LinkedIn. I don't actually post a lot on LinkedIn, but if you find me and I'll respond to direct messages, I'll send you copies of papers, I'll answer that question for you. What should I start reading? I'm always happy to give someone, try this, see how you react, and you can go from there.
And then you want to tell them about your current podcast?
My current
you like how I worded that,
my
right?
My current podcast is Safety of Work with Dave Proven. The easiest way to find it, because safety and work are fairly common terms, is actually to search for David Proven on your favourite podcast app, and you'll find it. My past and future podcast, apparently,
is
DisasterCast. Watch this space.
Right. No, DisasterCast is still one of the best podcasts out there, period. I mean, and I'm not saying that because you're sitting here with me. I really want you to know that's how I feel about it. And I went with the feeling comment just on purpose there. Drew Ray, thank you for coming by.
Thanks, Jay.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.